We're going to have a look at bravery today, what it really looks like when it comes to the crunch. Many of us are programmed to run away from danger. That is a reasonable response. But our next guest had to completely switch that around for some periods of his life. Cam Hardiman has worked for almost 35 years as a police officer, and for 13 of them in the rescue helicopter. And as you might expect, we'll be discussing some of the more difficult aspects of that job. So this conversation will have some heavy themes. Cam, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you.
Now, your job sometimes sounds like a Mission Impossible script. Let's talk about one particular rescue that got extremely hairy in Bass Strait. So it's February 2005. You get the call. Tell us what was happening.
Oh, well, we were actually on a job looking for a missing person in the metropolitan area just west of the city. And we got a call that was very basic, said there was a yachtsman that was out to sea in Bass Strait, about 65 miles offshore. And he'd lost his mast, he was injured, he was floundering in the ocean, being battered by waves, and he needed to be winched off.
And that sounds pretty basic and straightforward in police speak, but the time was against you, the weather was against you, it all sounds a bit precarious. Tell us what the context was there.
Well, that day we had, Melbourne had some pretty severe storms, and I remember going to work and hearing that the Spirit of Tasmania had to turn back because its portholes were broken. So I knew there was a big storm. And when we were searching for the missing child in near Werribee, the whole area was flooded. So there'd been heavy rain. So I knew it was bad. And when someone says you've got to go to Bass Strait to rescue someone, you look over towards Bass Strait and there's nothing but grey cloud and storms. But, you know, that's what our job was. So we had to leave that job searching for the kid, give it to another helicopter and head off back to base to prepare for the rescue of this gentleman, Ron Palmer.
And Bass Strait's never an easy place to operate, I understand. But also, people might not realise that the fuel situation is quite specific on a helicopter, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the more fuel you'll carry, the less people and weight you can carry, and also the less time you've got to spend actually out in the middle of Bass Strait winching. And it's a, you know, the fuel tanks are only so big. So the second you leave, the countdown starts. And you know exactly how long it takes to get 65 miles out to Bass Strait. And you know how long it roughly takes to do the winch and how much it takes to get back and where your nearest fuel are. So the countdown starts the second you leave.
And Ron Palmer, poor Ron, whose yacht had floundered in Bass Strait, there was a very specific plan that needed to happen around Ron getting winched off that boat, wasn't there? What was it meant to happen like?
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone's got their ideas of how it should be done, but it's really left up to us. And we were told on the way there that Ron had been instructed to sink his yacht, but he was only to sink it when I was winched onto the deck. But that doesn't suit me. And we had a discussion with the pilot and the winch operator and decided that what we'll do is when we get over the top, he can start sinking his yacht and then I'll get him off because I didn't want to hang around in the yacht. So that was our plan. And we arranged for that plan to be delivered to him. So there's no waiting around. So the idea was no more than 30 seconds on the yacht and get him off.
So you make it to where the yacht is finally. You find him. He's drifted a long way, of course, but you track him down.
Yeah.
What was the weather like? What did it look like when you started going down that cable?
The weather at the time, it's sort of the wind had slowed to about 60 knots. The waves were still large and had spray coming off the top of them, but the sun was out. It was quite weird. So we're sort of in the eye of the storm, but nothing had quietened down.
And then a bit later, things revved up a little, didn't they?
Yeah, a bit later, he never got the message to sink his boat. The second I landed it on the yacht, I was ready to put a harness around him, and he turned around to go downstairs and pull the valves, the seacock valves, which are these big valves that open up and let water in, to sink it. And I knew then he didn't get the message.
And the waves were a bit higher by that stage, weren't they?
Turned nasty. Big waves came. And unfortunately, there's a small window of opportunity and rough weather for the helicopter to remain over the top of the yacht and to have you get your work done. And that had passed. So with the wind and the waves and the pilot can't see the yacht, he's relying on commands from the winch operator. The helicopter went one way, yacht went the other way, and I got thrown overboard.
And at this stage, it's probably worth remembering for our listeners that you're not on a radio to your mates in the chopper, are you?
No, it's all hand signals. I give hand signals to the winch operator, and the winch operator gives verbal signals to the pilot, and that's how it stays over the top. Because you've got to imagine the pilot sitting over the top, the yacht's underneath, you can't see. So all the movements through voice commands from the winch operator.
So you were thrown into the water. Luckily, you've got really great co-workers who are managing the slack in the cable to try and make sure you don't get too damaged when you're down there. What happens next with Ron?
They eventually got me out of the water and we tried a couple more times to get onto the boat. And it was just too rough. So we'd already briefed that if I couldn't get onto the boat, I was going to go into the water and call him in. So they winched me into the water beside the boat. And we called Ron in, but he was a bit hesitant.
As you would be.
The guy was 73 years old. And trying to tell him to leave his nice yacht and get into the water was a bit too much. So eventually I had to yell at him. And he did. But it was more like a fall into the water than a volunteer step off.
And so the idea is that you slip this loop around him. What's it called again?
It's a rescue strop.
That's right. And it's like a loop that goes around his chest and he's securely strapped to you. It didn't quite play out like that, did it?
Yeah, well, I actually got it on him after fumbling around because he was really of no assistance. He's trying to stay afloat in the water, and so am I. I got it on him and there's a chest strap that we do up to make sure that I don't slip out, but I never got a chance before we got hit by a wave and went straight under. And then all of a sudden we were pulled out of the water. We were 30 feet in the air because the helicopter obviously climbed, the waves had disappeared underneath us and he was sitting on the harness like it was a swing. And within seconds he lost grip and fell backwards.
So, Cam, what's going through your mind at this stage? Is it all the training or is there room for some other emotions at that point?
I think there's room for emotion, but training takes over. I mean, I'd put a harness or a rescue strap on someone a couple of hundred times, whether it be in training or real life. And the amount of winches I did in training would exceed the hundreds. So it's almost like an automatic response, your motor muscle memory. But having him fall backwards was a surprise, to say the least. But I remember him something kicking me in the back of the shoulder, and that was his foot. So I grabbed hold of his leg with both hands and held on. But unfortunately, with both hands holding on to him, I can't give a signal to the winch operator. So we had to wait until the winch operator looked and said there's something wrong, which he obviously did. And the best thing to do when something's wrong is put us back in the water. So we went back in.
Which sounds counterintuitive to anyone who's not a professional who's going, just get me out of here. But you needed to readjust that strop, didn't you, around Ron?
Yeah, because if he fell out at 30 feet, it would have been all over. And we might not have been able to get him back. So it's easy to stay with him and make sure that the harness is fitted properly and then we get pulled out again.
And that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. So you make it back and eventually you get a bravery award for that rescue. How did you feel about that award at the time?
For someone that does this for a living and does rescues all the time and trains for it constantly, you feel like a bit of an imposter. And I remember sitting at Government House and it was about the time that one of the teachers at a university had got a bravery award as well for stopping a gunman that shot some students. And I looked at this guy and thought, now that's bravery. And so I really did feel like an imposter. And I'm looking around at people thinking, what are they thinking about me? I mean, it's hard to, when you're in a police uniform, it's hard to hide. And when they call out that the next award's going to the police helicopter crew, everyone looks at you. So I'd rather not have been there.
Well, and in the end, you started writing letters to them saying, I'm not happy with how you're describing what's going on here.
Yeah, well, at the time I didn't know I was suffering from symptoms of PTSD and had been for quite some time. So when an awards people write a description of what happened, I felt even more like a failure when it was incorrect. So I thought this was this huge job that I had to fight for. And when I read it, it wasn't so difficult. And it's almost like saying, you know, that fear that you felt or that struggle that you had, well, that didn't really happen because this is the way it was. And I would have done anything at that time to have them change the wording. And I was obsessed with it. And that's PTSD, being obsessed with it, to have it changed and the feeling of failure. Because during the winch, I actually had this very short moment of being absolutely scared. And that to me was a failure because I wasn't supposed to be.
That's really interesting. We're talking to Cameron Hardiman. His book's called 10 Feet Tall and Not Quite Bulletproof, which is a really good way to encapsulate the story that shifts throughout this book. Let's go back a little bit, Cam, to when you were growing up. What was your idea about fear and bravery back then? What did bravery look like?
Bravery looked like my dad. He'd fought in Malaya in an emergency where his best mate had died, and no one ever talked about a war in Malaya. No one knows about it, but it was before the Vietnam War and after the Korean War, and Australians died in it. So he was the person I thought was brave.
Did he talk about it much?
No. And still doesn't to this day. He doesn't want to pass it on to his family, and I get that because I'm doing that now.
And we'll talk a bit more about that, how things played out for you in the end. But did you look to pilots and armed forces personnel in particular as someone you could look up to?
Well, I was a RAF brat as a kid. So Dad was in the Air Force after the Army. And we lived near the Air Force base at Edinburgh. So we were always around planes and helicopters. Even though the helicopters weren't stationed there, I used to love going and seeing them at air shows. One thing the RAF did well was air shows back then, and they were doing them each year. And I loved it. Love the helicopters and love the Iroquois helicopters. And when you see on the TV in Vietnam, that was my favourite. It sounded fantastic. It looked great.
Yeah, my dad could tell the difference between various helicopter and plane engines from a distance. I was very impressed.
So can I.
Yep. Well, when you grew up, you decided that you would join the police force, and you were 18, which, you know, as a mum now, I think, oh, God, that's young. Was it something you'd always wanted to do?
No, I'd left school. I didn't do particularly well. And it got to the point where I needed some money, needed to find a job, and I saw a commercial on telly and thought, that looks fantastic. And being 18 wasn't that uncommon back then as a police officer. In fact, they had an age range between 18 and 35 back then. They even had a height requirement. So you had to be over 5'10". So times were different. So it wasn't abnormal to walk in the academy and see young kids walking around.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, you know, a lot of boys in particular were raised to think that being tough and being strong meant not talking about when you weren't feeling those things. Did the police training do anything to change that approach?
No, I think it sort of cemented it, really. You know, no one, when people ring the police, they're in trouble. No one rings the police when times are good. So when they're in trouble and really need them, and they don't want the police sitting around the corner panicking, they want them to come in and handle whatever it is the problem. It might be a break-in, an assault, or it might be someone's died and they call the police. So you can't have any emotion with that. You've got to go in and solve the problem, deal with it, move on to the next job.
Interestingly, though, you write really powerfully about how people debriefed after the really difficult jobs. You know, there was a black sense of humour that came out.
Yeah, black sense of humour I tried to put in the book, but I don't think too many people would understand it because to the uninitiated, it's quite offensive. But then there's the other side, it was alcohol. Alcohol was a big debriefer. It wasn't uncommon to finish work and go out a drink, sit at the pub for hours. On night shift, we used to go to a local park and drink around a barbecue that never got lit because we never had any food. It was just about the alcohol. And that's how we debriefed.
And how effective was that in the long term?
Short term, great. Long term, bad. It just wasn't the right way to do it, especially with each other.
Do you think there were many of your co-workers who went home to their partners and talked to them at all?
No, I'd say there were none. A lot of people say that coppers don't want to go home and talk to their partners about their bad day because they don't want to offload any bad stuff. But I think it's also a bit about not wanting to revisit it because the second you walk out the door at work, you want to forget about it. Most coppers would go home, turn the TV on. Their partners would say, "How was your day, dear?" And the answer would be, "Okay." Anything else happen? No. And they might have gone to a fatal accident or a serious assault, but they leave that at the door when they walk out.
Well, and for you, Cam, there were hints that maybe those experiences were accumulating and having an impact on you. For example, after the Russell Street bombing, tell us about what happened there that made you think maybe something's not quite right here.
When the Russell Street bomb went off, I was actually two blocks away in a cinema that's now gone. It was in Russell Street Cinemas, and I ran out the front door and ran towards headquarters because I heard on the radio that headquarters had been bombed. And I got right to the intersection within about 30 metres of the wreck of the car that had blown up, and that's it. I can't remember anything else after that. So I have this period of about 5 hours that's missing because I can't remember doing anything until later that evening when I started doing searches. The problem is I can see pictures of the car, but I don't know whether it's my memory or it's because I saw it on the TV or the newspaper. But there's definitely about a 4 to 5 hour block. I can't remember at all.
It must be a tricky thing in your job too, because the things that you might want to forget crop up on the news again. You see them over and over.
I don't watch the news anymore. I can't afford to. You know, it even gets to the point where I was discussing with a friend the other day who worked on another air ambulance helicopter, and he went to a fatal accident where nearly a whole family died, and then they put out the white crosses on the side of the road, and the poor guy had to drive past those white crosses every day for 12 months on the way to work. He could never forget it. And I do that too. So I don't watch the news. But I don't listen to the radio.
I don't read
newspapers. So I feel like a bit of a leper when people talk about current affairs, because I've got no idea. But I have no intention. But there's reminders everywhere. They don't have to be white crosses on the side of the road. They could be a smell, a name of something, anything.
Cameron Hardiman, the incident in Bass Strait made you reflect on how helpless you are on the end of a winch cable, and also how much trust you've got to have in your workmates, and you decided eventually that you needed to change course. So you went and did a few different things. You did some stints on Christmas Island. Can't imagine how that would be much easier, but there you go. Do you mind telling us, Cam, about the time when all those hints kind of snowballed into a big experience that hit you on a train one day?
Well, it started at Christmas Island. I was over there with a people smuggling investigation, and the flight in was quite horrific. Eventually got to Christmas Island, and that's when everything started to come back. All I could think about at night was Ron Palmer's rescue, and by the time a couple of months had changed, I'd started to remember things about jobs that I hadn't thought about in years, about resuscitating a person that had died on a yacht. A truck accident when a poor gentleman, the driver, had choked to death. That was in 1994. And all these memories started flooding back, and I was losing sleep rapidly. And eventually I was just on the way home from work on the train, and my world caved in. The tears started flowing. I couldn't breathe. I was panicking, shaking. I could feel my heart rate go through the roof. And that was on and off for the whole trip. And eventually, I don't know how I got myself off the train, but I'm standing there in front of my wife and kids who are picking me up from the station, sheer panic, not knowing what's going on. And I was diagnosed with PTSD 3 days later.
And you were, in a way, really lucky, weren't you? Your wife knew a psychiatric nurse who could come over that night and help you in the immediate aftermath, and then you got a GP who was like, Cam, we know what's happening here.
Well, Nadia was the friend of my wife, so I'd never met the lady. And I remember my wife, when I was in absolute panic, I was sitting on the bed, and Susan, my wife, was trying to ring as many friends as possible. I remember one of the psychologists in the AFP saying we need to get a CAT team, which is a psychologist, a doctor, and a nurse. And in dealing with CAT teams back when I was a uniformed police officer, they took people away, because that's why we called them. So I said, I'm not having a CAT team in the house. So I settled for Nadia, who was a psych nurse who happened to work on a CAT team, and I met her for the first time in tears, shaking, couldn't breathe, and she calmed me down. I don't know how she did it. And with the doctor the following day, I'd known this doctor for years, and her brother was a police officer, and she took one look at me and said, I know what's going on.
And she talked about getting a really good sedative, getting the psychologist and putting a few other things in place and stopping working. What was that like to hear that news?
Pretty hard to be told that your police career after 30-something years has come to an end. And it's all I ever knew. I've never had another job. It took months to get used to that, but I eventually did. And you come to a sort of an agreement with yourself about forgetting about work and trying to get better. And that takes time. Takes lots of medication and lots of therapy.
Well, and you've done such a great job of hiding it from everyone else. So how has your family coped?
Oh, look, they cop the brunt of it, really do. And, you know, the poor kids, one of the telltale signs of PTSD is anger and short temper and lack of patience. And I never thought I was a patient person in the first place. So I can really go off and scare the hell out of my kids. And I've had them running into their rooms and crying in the corner. And I think of some of the things that happened to me as a kid and I still remember. And I'm sure they'll remember that long before I'm gone, which is disappointing. So now I try and spend as much quality time with the kids as possible.
Well, Cam, I was wondering, a little kid who met you and heard about the things you'd done in your life would say, you're a hero, you're a brave guy. How would you feel about that?
Embarrassed. The term 10 feet tall and bulletproof is a common phrase in policing. It's about putting on the uniform and thinking you can do anything they ask you to. And you really do believe that. And I did. So I don't think that's brave to do what they're paying me to do. I see bravery as my father and the younger kids that went to war years and years ago and crossed the trenches and those that fought in World War II and Vietnam. They're heroes, not me.
I think we'll let our listeners decide about that, Cameron Hardiman. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
Cam's the author of 10 Feet Tall and Not Quite Bulletproof. And if this conversation has raised any issues for you, there's always someone to chat to on Lifeline. 24 hours a day, they're on 13 11 14. And you're on Life Matters.